You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Steelworkers Local 12561 and Sheet Metal Workers Local 2, bringing you quality service and safe natural gas from USW Local 12561, serving Kansas Gas Service and Missouri Gas Energy customers. And Sheet Metal Workers Local 2 represents 1,200 members in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. We start with the sheet metal and make nearly anything out of it for industry, heating and air conditioning, architectural roofs and siding, kitchens, and even works of art. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Reverend William Barber has inspired thousands of Moral Mondays movement in the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina and across the nation. We'll hear why he thinks America lacks heart. Then, teachers are fighting back against the attacks. Meet Badass Teachers Unite. In the news, the more border enforcement, the more undocumented migrants in the U.S., new study finds. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams, and she'll give a quick review for legislators on sexual harassment. Now for the news.
According to the Boston Globe, Logan airport workers took to the picket lines Wednesday, the second strike this summer by airport contract employees demanding higher pay and the right to organize. More than 100 employees of G2 Secure Staff, which provides services for Delta, American, and other airlines, were expected to demonstrate throughout the day at Logan, the East Boston offices of G2, and the South Station. The workers say they were threatened by the firm after similar work action in January, according to 32BJ Service Employees International Union. They are telling G2 to stop breaking the law, says 32BJ organizer Eugenio Villasante. G2 Secure Staff did not immediately return a call seeking comment. Judith Mendez, a customer service agent for G2, was among the protesters. I need benefits and I need a raise, said Mendez, 34, who is raising three teenagers in East Boston and makes $10 an hour. Many of the airport employees make as little as $10 per hour without access to affordable health benefits, according to the union.
The state of California is coming under increasing scrutiny for the way in which they are managing natural disasters, particularly forest fires, and the labor they are using to handle these emergencies. Just this year, 4,382 wildfires have raised over 117,960 acres of woods, threatening thousands of homes and contributing to Governor Jerry Brown's unprecedented decision to restrict the amount of water Californians can use. California has a staff of about 6,000 dedicated to fighting wildfires, but these days that's not nearly enough people to get the job done. In order to compensate for not having enough staff, California is using about 4,000 prison inmates to work in fire camps, clearing out brush and battling 50-foot-high flames. The arrangement, where prisoners supplement the state's public employees, saves the state around $80 million a year. This arrangement came into the limelight most recently when California's Deputy Attorney General argued in court against releasing too many inmates because there might not be enough prisoners to help work in the event of a massive forest fire. While many prisoners appreciate the chance to be out in nature, working towards the public good rather than be in prison, This arrangement certainly raises question about the use of prison labor as a form of undercutting wages for non-incarcerated workers.
The Pacific Standard reports that not so long ago, migration between Mexico and the United States followed a circular pattern whereby migrants moved regularly between the two countries, chasing seasonal jobs. But recent research published in the Journal of Ethnic and Migration Studies finds that immigration policies and the militarization of our southern border have disrupted this pattern, effectively caging the undocumented immigrants rather than keeping them out as intended. Workers used to come for 6 months' work as part of the Bracero program, then they'd go back home to Mexico. Sometimes the workers had visas and sometimes not. Then, in 1986, Congress passed the IRCA, which is the Immigration Reform and Control Act, making it illegal to hire the undocumented and also increasing the Border Patrol. Researchers from Princeton University and Mexico University of Guadalajara calculated the probability of in and out migration across the border by Mexicans over time. Before 1986, the probability of returning to Mexico from the U.S. was high for both legal and undocumented migrants, and after that, the likelihood of return migration rose for documented migrants but fell for undocumented workers, according to the analysis. The study found that by 2010, the probability of undocumented migration fell to an all-time low, but the authors emphasized that it's definitely not because of the increased U.S. border enforcement, which had no significant effect on the likelihood of taking a first undocumented trip, that is, the initial trek from Mexico to the U.S. Instead, the authors attribute the decline to the rising age of the Mexican population and the falling labor demand in the U.S., among other things. The study did find a correlation between the Border Patrol's budget and the likelihood that migrants would return home to Mexico. However, for every $1 million increase in budget, the odds and a migrant would actually return home to Mexico in any given year dropped by 89%. So border enforcement policies have actually backfired, it seems, resulting in a net increase in undocumented migrants in the U.S.
Allegheny Technologies Incorporated, or AIT, locked out 2,200 workers at 12 plants in six states on August the 14th. Leo Girard, president of the United Steelworkers, said it's outrageous that the company has chosen this destructive path, but it's clear that ATI intended to lock these workers out since day one. From the beginning, the company has bargained in bad faith. The lockout is the culmination of months long campaigns by ATI management to force workers to accept draconian concessions. It's spending millions of dollars on bringing outsiders to replace skilled and experienced union members, even though the union has never threatened to strike or even conducted a strike authorization vote. Starting in January, months before the contract negotiations between USW and ATI began, ATI management hired outside consultants to recruit replacement workers and force union members to sit through captive audience meetings aimed at intimidating them into accepting concessions. Beginning in May, the union presented ATI management with proposals that would save the company millions of dollars, but management consistently rebuffed the union's efforts to work with the company to address challenges in the market. On August 4th, USW presented management with proposals that made substantial movements in the company's direction. The union offered tens of millions of dollars in savings on benefit costs, but ATI responded with a last, best, and final contract offer and threatened to lock out its workers if the union failed to present the offer to members for ratification by 3 p.m. August 10th, just 4 days later. The USW Bargaining Committee voted to return to their plants and hold confidential consultations with their members to determine whether to hold ratification votes on management offer. Before this could happen, ATI locked them out. This story actually follows a familiar playbook practiced in negotiations by companies since the 1980s. It's a classic example of modern-day union busting.
Finally, in the interest of resolving the Missouri legislature's current dilemma over what to wear, we'd like to suggest a new dress code for the legislature. This is not for the interns. Yesterday's proposed dress code for them has been shot down around the world. No, we'd like to suggest a new dress code for all legislators, staffers, or any other elected officials who have ever tweeted, texted, propositioned, or groped any intern, male or female, in an inappropriate manner. It's a simple, all-purpose piece of clothing, a straitjacket. The news was read by Jake White, Molly Madden, Beth Pike, Michael Savoir, and I'm Zaira Gordillo.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. The introduction you've just heard was the song Sad Songs for Broken Hearts, followed by the sound of a defibrillator and the powerful voice of Reverend William Barber II as he spoke in Union Station on June 11th. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm your host for both the first and the second halves of our show. On June 11th of this year, Kansas City organization Moore Squared held their annual fundraiser and invited Reverend William Barber to be the keynote speaker. Reverend Barber addressed the crowd of 700 people and stated that America has a heart problem. Tonight we have a panel of folks who heard the speech and want to talk about it. On June 11th, Reverend Barber energetically said that that activists need to be defibrillators for social justice and deliver America a heart fix. For our discussion tonight, we have Reverend Rodney Williams, who's the pastor of Swope Parkway United Christian Church. Also attending the Moore Square dinner was Lon Swearingen, and longtime civil rights and labor activist Michael Savoir is joining our table. Welcome, everybody, and especially you, Reverend Williams.
It's good to be here.
Indeed.
Thank you.
So can you tell us more about the organization Moore Squared?
Yes, I can. Moore Square is short for the Metro Organization for Racial and Economic Equity. And what we do is we look into situations that are inequitable, people are being marginalized, and we step in to try to do the best we can to help them.
So you are involved in a range of social justice issues.
Yes, we are involved in a lot of educational issues here in Kansas City. We are partnering with the fast food workers strike, and anything that is inequitable about in life of people in Kansas City, we try to do what we can to walk with them and walk beside them.
And can you tell us a little bit about Reverend Barber's background and why you invited him?
Well, yes, I've known Reverend Barber for about 25, 26 years. He's a native of Indianapolis, Indiana, but he grew up in North Carolina in a segregation area in the South. And he's had a prophetic voice for a long time. But the reason that we invited Reverend Barber was, first and foremost, we believe that Reverend Barber has the most prophetic voice at this point in time in America. And since Moore Square is a prophetic organization in the business of doing transformation of lives here in Kansas City and abroad, we believe that if Reverend Barber would come, he could energize us and also help us to galvanize others to participate in the movement.
Okay, and in Reverend Barber, through especially this speech on June 11th, says that America has a heart problem. Do you all agree, and what did he mean by that?
Well, I don't want to sound like Malcolm, but America was conceived in violence, in inequity, and certainly in lack of apathy or feelings from the heart, you know, and we've treated one another in that way from the very inception of this country. And so, yes, we have a heart problem. I mean, we've got some serious problems with compassion for one another, and particularly how we treat the least of us.
And the other thing that would be is that we have to recognize we can't just talk about it. We have to walk our talk. And that's what Moore Square is about, is trying to basically make sure that people do things rather than talk about them.
I would also suggest that, yes, America does have a heart problem. And as a result of having a heart problem, America has no moral compass. And the reason I say that America has no moral compass is because whenever you can have a state that will intentionally vote away the Medicaid expansion and people are going to die, I would say America has a heart problem. When we have school systems that are consistently not being fully funded, I would say America has a heart problem. I would also say that when the city council passes an ordinance that lifts the minimum wage and there's a referendum that comes in, and that referendum can stop those individuals from receiving that living wage, I would say, yes, America has a heart problem.
So Reverend Barber also in his speech talked about the need to shock the nation into having a heart or having a normally breathing heart. Did Reverend Barber mean that really we're on the verge of death as a society? Do you think that's what he was saying? Because he did bring up that we need to shock the nation, meaning defibrillate the nation by marching, by speaking up, by getting arrested, such as the Moral Monday movement's already doing. Are we in an emergency situation? That's what I want to know.
Chris, I would say that the metaphor was quite apropos. In other words, you know, as I've already recognized, you know, we lack compassion as a society, you know, and it's evident in everything we say, we do. I mean, we look at the greed. We look at the selfishness. We look at the proliferation of inequity that has become synonymous with this country. And I would say, yes, we're on, you know, we're on an emergency list of some sort. This is critical, you know, and we're just giving it lip service. In other words, I can recognize that the efforts that Reverend Baber is making with his Moral Monday initiatives, perhaps, is just what is needed. We need to bring to the critical awareness of the public the nature of this emergency and how imperative it is that we first of all identify it, because we've been in denial about it for so long. You know, until we identify it, we can't do anything about it.
There was a mayor, he talked about a mayor in North Carolina that watched one of his friends die because there wasn't any Medicaid expansion. And he asked Reverend Barber how he could do something. And what they did was, he said, go to Washington, do a march, and that's what the mayor is doing. And this is the kind of thing that has to happen. You have to wake up, because there are people dying because of no Medicaid expansion. This is a real problem in our country and in many states that have not expanded Medicaid.
I also agree that I think that America is in a state of emergency, a moral emergency, and I believe that the only way that is going to change is if there's a growing and consistent grassroots effort to speak truth to the power structures, because that is the way that we can bring about the change that's needed. So I would say, yes, we need to be the defibrillators and help to shock America back to its senses.
Yeah. Now, what influence do you think the Black Lives Matter movement has had on the ability of America to make a movement? How do you think that's influencing other movements like labor rights or labor issues?
Chris, in my opinion, education is the first step. And certainly the Black Lives Matter movement has been serving to educate the American public at large. You know, it goes so much further than that, though, because it's brought this inequity that's been going on. Believe me, this is not the things that Black Lives Matter movement are addressing didn't just start happening. I mean, this has been going on from the very inception of this country. Let's recognize we were born literally in slavery, and we've perpetuated that system. Even though slavery has been abolished, you know, 150 years ago, the remnants of that are still being perpetuated. They've never really been addressed in ways that are satisfactory. Clearly, the movement itself has brought to the forefront. But beyond that, I think we each and every individual in this country needs to recognize the consequences of this and make a concerted effort to personally be part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
So I'm taking, you all are confident that the future can hold a concerted together movement for social justice change here. Are you optimistic, or are you?
If I was not optimistic, I would not be here today. Yes, I am. I'm very optimistic. You have the Black Lives Matter. You have the Moral Monday movement. You have the low wage movement, where people have been galvanized across the country. And I believe people are at a point where they feel that they just can't take it anymore. And the system, the problem is systematic racism. It's up front in our faces, and people are saying we're not going to take it anymore. And I believe that's going to be the sustaining power, that the problem is here. We can see it. We now have all of these devices, cell phones, where things are being captured where they were not captured before. So I believe all of these things working together is going to help give some sustainability to these movements.
And in fact, the Black Lives Matter movement has really like you said, Michael, pushed it to the fore and named it. Mm-hmm. It is. So I can't see anything but good coming from that.
Absolutely. You know, when we look at some of the successes Reverend Baber's had with his Moral Monday movement, I mean, it spread way beyond North Carolina. It's moved into Georgia and South Carolina. And,
right.
You know, and in fact, it's gone north. In other words, I mean, you know, certainly the inequities that we live in are not exclusive in the South. You know, it's a problem in Kansas City. It's the same problem in Boston. It's the same problem in, you name it, it's there. And so with that in mind, it's critically important that we recognize how we're all involved in this. And I think that's happening. I mean, with the Black Lives Matter movement, I know locally, there have been more white folks involved than black folks. And that's good, you know, because we're starting to take ownership that we as a nation, this is our problem. It ain't just their problem, you know. And with that, then we can start making the inroads that are necessary for us to have the kind of brotherly love and concern that is imperative if this nation is going to survive.
So let me throw this out then. Are we in the midst of a new civil rights movement, but we haven't named that yet, or we're naming it in the Moral Monday movement and the Black Lives Matter? And what evidences do we have that this movement is in Kansas City?
Yes, I think, I don't even want to say a new civil rights movement necessarily, because we're picking up the same fight that was fought in the 60s. I would like to say maybe a resurgence of a civil rights movement. One of the things I'm seeing in Kansas City is stand up for KC. The demonstrations that Moore Square has been putting on. I believe that these are all starts of a movement. And people in Kansas City are starting to talk now more than ever before about the same issues. So I think, yes, that we are at the beginning of a new movement. And I think the new movement is viable, and I think it's going to stand for a long time. And I think we're going to make major changes. But let me also say this. I heard a preacher say this once, and he said, one of the things we have to do is commit to an issue that we know we may not win until we die. And then we have to understand that someone has to come behind us to take up that same issue. So I don't know when equity in America is going to be realized, but we have to fight as if it is and train younger people to come behind us and continue in that fight.
Yeah, in the union movement, the Chicago teachers say that the mark of a good leader is to create other leaders. So that would follow what you say about leadership.
And I would be quick to say that the civil rights movement was never complete. You know, in other words, we never brought it to an end. You know, we refused to even answer the fundamental questions that it raises. You know, and when I think in terms of what those are, you know, and I'm not talking about the kind of reparations that are monetary necessarily, but I'm talking about the kind of awareness that brings it to the forefront so it can be dealt with, rather than push it away as if, you know, we've found a solution. We've got a black president, so it makes it okay, or we've passed the voter rights this, or we did that, and that's the conclusion. The conclusion has never been realized.
Well, actually, I've never heard Reverend Barber talk about President Obama, except occasionally to defend certain actions and things. So, I think I agree with you that the civil rights movement has never really ended. It's just continuing.
It's just continuing, yeah. Right.
As Reverend Barber always talked, it's about we. It's about we. And there is what it takes. All of us together, becoming together, is what it's about. To basically use the defibrillator, basically, we have to really all be there to help. And that's what I said in the beginning. You've got to be able to walk the talk. Just not talking about it is going to make it. You have to believe that it will happen. And if you go to the suffrage deal, it's very simple. It started in the 1800s, and they get it to until 1920. So these are things that go on for that. And if you keep hope alive, it will happen. That's the way I look at it.
I like to just read a quote from Reverend Barber. He says, "Love and justice have never lost. They might get crucified. They might get beat down. But at the end of the day, when the fame is over and the dust settles, justice and love always wins. So get your head up. It's time to walk. It's time to march. Forward together, not one step back."
And there we have the theme of the Moral Monday movement.
Yes.
Yes. Fabulous.
So get your defibrillators out, people. We all got work to do.
Okay, and our time is up, and I'd like to thank everybody, Michael Savoir, Reverend Williams, and Lon Swearingen, for coming to talk about the continuing movement that we all need to build and be part of in Kansas City. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, for having us on.
Christmas in October, volunteers help folks in need by doing home repairs. If you are 62 years of age or older, or disabled, or have a veteran in the home, and live in either Kansas City, Kansas, or Kansas City, Missouri, call them at 816-531-6443, or go online at christmasinoctober.org. This message is brought to you by 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
This week on The Bioneers.
We need to develop these communities that turn pain to power and turn pain to planting. I don't think you can heal from trauma alone. It is community that heals.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week we go from pain to power with feminist playwright Eve Ensler and permaculturalist Brock Dolman on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
Congratulations, KKFI listeners. Mountain Sprout, Not a Planet, My Brothers and Sisters, Katie Ginn and the Girls, and Sarah Morgan are all playing at the Crossroads Music Fest, presented by Sprint on September 12th. Tickets are on sale right now at cmfkc.com. Saturday, September 12th at 6 p.m., 35 bands on 7 stages. Also, Pink Royal, God Project, Rural Grit All-Stars, Connor Limer, Mod Professor, Willie Arthur Smith's Marching Cobras, with support from the Neighborhood Terrace Development Fund, Crossroads Music Fest, Saturday, September 12th. All information and tickets at cmfkc.com.
The problem with teachers is, what's a kid going to learn from someone who decided his best option in life is to become a teacher?
The financial meltdown has dealt a painful blow to our nation's schools.
Music, art, and sports activities all being threatened with elimination.
Our schools have to get used to living on a lot less money than they've had.
Well, it's the biggest wave in school closings ever.
Thousands of public schools are shutting down.
Lots of ugly cuts going on here.
Is calling for the closing of half the schools.
Fewer teachers and fewer schools.
They got these fools closing schools and it can't be ignored. As if our future is a budget line we cannot afford. They got no money for schools, but they got funding for war. They say the conversation's closed. I say we break down the door. I say we stand up for our children, join together and fight. Cause you can see that on the surface what they're doing's not right. They don't deserve this. Now they're nervous that their answer's not right. And are they gonna lose their school and teacher? Yeah, well they might. Cause it's a messed up system as we race to a stop. Blaming on the teachers, aiming fire and shots. Kids caught in the fire, do their best in the test. Is this what they desire? A class culture and stress. With no art, no music, no joy, no love. The answer is E, none of the above. Cause my people are strong with passion. They're right here and they're saying stop this madness loud and clear. Imagine all the money in test companies' pockets. Where every form equates to financial profits. Where state ed mandates and you can't stop it. It's in private hands with no watchdogs to watch it. It's mental warfare labeling students in schools. Like we can't see what's going on as if my people are fools. What damage does it do? Cause believe me, kids know that they participate in failure in your eyes when they go. Do they participate in failure just for growing up poor? And how is that?
Welcome to the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum. The song you've just heard was Frontlines by Jeremy Dudley, middle school teacher in Albany, New York. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm your host for this evening's program. In late July, I attended the Badass Teachers Congress in Washington, D.C. I heard a lot about the group and was curious to see what this organization was like, especially since they call themselves Badass Teachers, or BATS for short. Tonight, I will play some interviews of a few of the 300 participants at the BAT Congress. I must acknowledge, however, these are excerpts from interviews conducted by a great labor radio host from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, whose name is Rick Smith. You can hear the full interviews from his website, www.thericksmithshow.com. A link to these interviews and his website will be posted on the Heartland Labor Forum website. Rick is an outstanding interviewer and an outstanding labor advocate. The Badass Teachers events span a three or four day time period. Teachers organize trips to Capitol Hill to educate legislators about important and acute issues such as the overuse of standardized testing, unfair firing of teachers, lack of tenure, and lack of funding for public education, as well as the privatization of public education. That day was followed by a celebratory end of a 400-mile walk by Jesse Turner, who walked from Connecticut to Washington, D.C., to call attention to the harm being done by the overuse of standardized testing. Later that evening, we witnessed a mock trial where the Department of Education, philanthropists such as Eli Broad were put on trial for converting public education to private entities. The third day of the Congress was a day-long gathering where teachers and parents gathered to share information and plan for future actions. Well, on to our first interview. Gus Morales is president of his teachers union in Mount Holyoke, Massachusetts, and he was fired twice from his teaching jobs for speaking out. Gus discusses the role unions serve for all of our lives. Remember, these interviews were actually conducted by Rick Smith, and the full-length version can be downloaded or listened to from the website, thericksmithshow.com.
It really is. It's an anti-union tactic that we've seen play out over the years, this idea that you can somehow extricate the teachers from the union they belong to, not realizing that the union is comprised of teachers. So you, when you attack the union and you say you love teachers, you're being a hypocrite.
Yeah, I mean, it's just weird to me. And I look at places, a little earlier we talked with a woman from Virginia that, where it's a right-to-work state, and she wouldn't give her name. She's like, you know, I can't because I could be fired. And you go, you think about it, in a lot of states, like Pennsylvania is an at-will state, you can be fired for anything. Doesn't matter. You can be fired for having blue shoes on this day. But if you have a union contract, you have that contract. You can't just be fired. You have to have due process.
Right. Well, the due process is the one thing they don't want. And there's some interesting research out there already. If you take all 50 states and you rank them according to the most unionized to the least unionized, and the most unionized is my state, Massachusetts, and then you take Mississippi, which is the least unionized. And then you look at the student outcomes of our states, and you realize that there's a correlation between the heavily unionized state and the states that don't have unions. They're protecting them and representing them. Because what we believe strongly as, you know, myself as a union president, but also other people that I work with, what we believe is that the teachers' working conditions are inherently the students' learning conditions, and the two cannot be separated. Right. I mean, when you look at the anti-unionism that has cropped up in the last several years, you know, people like Campbell Brown, who want to get rid of tenure and really just despise unions, what they fail to tell you is that, you know, unions are the backbone of this country. You know, I always tell people, if you enjoy your 8-hour workday, thank a union member. You know, unions are the ones that put people to work. Unions are the ones that built up the middle class. And all of a sudden, we've been demonized, and now we're the bad guys. And I just don't see how we can respect the idea of unionism in terms of enjoying our weekends, enjoying our holidays, enjoying our 8-hour workday, enjoying the fact that children don't go to work when they're 10 years old for 14 hours a day. Well, and then at the same time, criticize unions for getting better working conditions for union members. Right. Instead of people criticizing unions, what I wish they would do is say, you know what? I like what the union guys have. I want some of that, so let me start my own union at this workplace. And I think if we start thinking about it in terms of reciprocity, we might actually have a better conversation. You can see it play out with charter schools. You know, when you get rid of the union and you start paying teachers a lot less, and then you strip certifications, and you have these really, I don't mean to be demeaning of anybody who teaches at a charter school. I'm adamantly opposed to charter schools, but not necessarily the teachers who work there, or definitely not the students.
They're motivated.
Right. But if you look at their pay versus public school teachers, they get paid a lot less. Their hours are longer. And so then you start seeing the impetus for why they want to get rid of unions, because they want to pay us less and they want to work us even more, which is to the detriment of the students. Because when you have a tired, exhausted, anxious teacher, what you have is a teacher that can't be productive and can't do their job as well as they could if the conditions were much better.
Let's talk about you for a minute, because you've become the center of some of this anti-union attack, some of this let's go after them. I understand you've been fired now, I guess, the second time?
Yeah, I've been fired for the second time now. I got fired June 2014 the first time. I'm very vocal about my stance, not only on unionism, but also against testing, against Common Core, against charter schools, against the demonization of my entire profession. So I'm very vocal about my stance. This bothers some people. It bothered my superintendent to the point where he issued a trespass notice against me and banned me from any public school property for an entire year. It was rescinded within 24 hours of it being issued, but the fact that they issued it is really telling. Well, when you got people like Bill Gates, he's pretty much the single hand that pushed through Common Core with his, you know, endless
with
amounts
his billion,
of money.
Sure.
Yeah. But if you look at people like that and the way they see teachers, they see us as cogs, as pieces of a much greater machine, and we're human beings. We're not pieces of a machine. And people often have a hard time believing what I say. So I tell them, if you want, go on YouTube and watch him speak. His ideal classroom is 100 computer screens with 100 students in front of them and one moderator, not even a teacher,
right.
A moderator just to make sure that those kids are following the curriculum on that computer screen. That's the antithesis of what real learning looks like. There's no interaction between human beings, and they're just sitting in front of a computer. So when you have a person like that that's dictating education reform here in the United States, that's hugely problematic because of the amount of money he can use to influence these
Absolutely.
Policies.
And instead of what we used to do in the good old days of the 40s and 50s, tax them and mm-hmm. take the money and invest
right.
in education. We now beg them.
Yes.
And it's really twisted to me. I mean, I look at my kids' classrooms, and there's reading programs by Pizza Hut, and there's math by McDonald's, and there's all of this corporate sponsorship of all these different things. And I'm going, wait a second. When did my kids' classroom become NASCAR?
I hate to put it this way, but public education has become the entrepreneurial wet dream. There's so much money to be made off of the kids, and it's really sickening. I mean, when I look at it, and I look at it from the vantage point of not just a teacher, but as a president of a union, but also as a citizen of the city that I live in, Holyoke, Massachusetts, I'm disgusted that people see these kids as some kind of profit margin, some kind of bottom line that they can adjust and manipulate. And if you actually listen to some of the speeches given by the millionaires and the CEOs of some of these education companies, they're talking about how much more money they could be making and how to, you know, utilize any strategy they can to cut their costs and make even more money. If you look at Pearson specifically, they've like tripled, quadrupled their net worth in the last decade from the time we implemented No Child Left Behind, which made testing mandatory for all 50 states. And all of a sudden you have a testing conglomerate that is making money off of the backs of children and teachers. That's anti-American in my eyes. Well, I say anti-American in the sense of democracy.
Right.
What we're doing is we're ripping democracy out of the hands of the people who need it the most, and there's no voice for them anymore. It's being taken away. Public education should be one of those few areas in our country that are off limits to businesses and corporations to profit off of. I mean, because we're talking about public education as the cornerstone of democracy, and we don't want billionaires influencing that. We want it to be natural, and we want it to be authentic, and we want every single child, no matter what zip code they live in, to have a quality education, right? Because right now what we see is cities like mine versus some more affluent cities are getting robbed of an education, and it's not because of the teachers. Teachers are the scapegoats right now, but it's just inherently wrong to blame the teachers for the policies that they don't create. And not only did they not create the policies, but they're never asked about the policies. Whenever you make business decisions, you ask business people. You include them in the decision-making, so you're making sure you're making good decisions that are sound. But when we make education decisions, for whatever reason, I don't know how it started, but I'm here to fix it, but we are left completely out of the conversation for anything education related.
And well, I guess it's because you think it's about education. I think as you laid it out a second ago, it's really about business.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum in on Kansas City Community Radio, KKFI 90.1 FM. Tonight we're hearing a report back from the Badass Teachers Congress held in Washington, D.C. on July 24th through 26th. Bess Altweiger from Save Our Schools explains the purpose of public education in our next interview.
We want education to be capable of developing an individual that can live out their potential and to find the kind of work in their life that is fulfilling and supports them. But we also have to remember that we're not just a bunch of individuals. We're a society. And if this society is supposed to be a democratic society, we need to be thinking in terms of what we need as a society so that we can continue to grow.
Right.
And change in the way that we see education as just, well, I'll use the corporate terminology, they like to call it a workforce development system. That's what schools are. It's in their literature. It's right. A workforce development system. And when we think of school as only a place where where you produce products, which are students, that are going to fit into the mold of what the corporate sector wants in terms of jobs, you completely leave out what the whole purpose of education was originally, which was to build the foundation of a democratic society.
Of well-informed, educated voters. Yeah.
Exactly. You need a citizenry that can think critically, can problem solve. That we have all of these tremendous problems that are facing the globe, not just our society, but the whole world. If we're not going to produce a new generation of kids that can problem solve and think out of the box and be creative.
A major focus of the Badass Teacher Congress was analyzing high-stakes tests or standardized testing. Jesse Turner, whom we've previously interviewed on the Heartland Labor Forum, walked 400 miles from Connecticut to D.C. In several speeches at the Congress, Jesse referred to the research that influenced him to take such a strong stance against the overuse of standardized testing. Again, the interview excerpts you're hearing are the work of Labor Talk Show host Rick Smith. Log on to the website, thericksmithshow.com, to hear the full interviews.
This is my second walk. I walked the first time in 2010 because I had gone this route before. I'm a researcher. I look at the data, the federal government's intervention programs, their programs that they called effective programs for literacy, have all failed. It's been 10 years of data from 2002 all the way to now. The data shows that not one of the programs that they have proposed, the billions of dollars, the years, the schools they have closed, the people that they have beat up to institute these programs, the data is in. And the data shows that they're called the experimental groups because in medicine, I'd give this new treatment to the person and you're hoping there's no cure. You're hoping that if you get the medicine, you'll get better. And that's called the experimental group.
Right.
The control group gets the same, and you don't really want to be in that group. You feel sorry for that group. In medicine, they call it the protocol because they don't want you to know. Nobody's allowed to know. They're not getting anything. They're getting the placebo, the
right.
Sugar pill. Now, the data came in, impact study 2008, impact study 2009, impact study 2010. Every one of those experimental programs for literacy showed a decline in comprehension. Not one of them. Now, the control groups, the ones that you should feel sorry for, they're the only ones that showed growth. For me, in 2010, I walked to D.C. because I could not understand how the Capitol in D.C., Congress, the Senate, how they could not have investigated hearings on in that Capitol building. They go to Benghazi, Wingazi, you name it, whatever it is. They have an investigative hearing for everything, but they did not call Secretary Duncan in. They did not call Secretary Page in. They did not call Secretary Spelling in. $1.2 trillion wasted on programs that the data shows are ineffective. They did not call them in. But you know what? They did say, oh, the children's test scores, we're worried about them. We're so worried about the children's test scores. That's because it's the old switcheroo. We don't want you to look at what we're doing. We want to put the blame on you. So they blamed the children. Then they started blaming the teachers. So, yeah, I walked in 2010, and I'm still walking. I'll give you an example. I have a program. I'm the director of our literacy center. So it's a different kind of academic. Yes, I teach the assessment. I teach the testing courses, actually. But I also, we run a center where we give over $200,000 worth of free tutoring by certified teachers to struggling readers and writers. And over the years, what I've found is those kids are in pain. Their parents are in pain. Those teachers are coming back to me and saying, Dr. Turner, what we're doing is malpractice. And so in that kind of stuff, it's where's the humanity in this? So I just want you to know that I've been close to children. And these people can say they love children all they want. They are not close to the children who are being tested. They are not close to the children in our schools. They are not close to our school. They may drive by for a photo op in the morning, and they're out of there in 5 minutes, and then they're playing golf, sipping champagne, flying on someone's private jet somewhere, but they are not present. In the data, when No Child Left Behind came in, what Rod Page, Secretary Page, who lost 15 high school dropouts, we had a Texas miracle. And somehow everyone graduated 1 year, and they already made him the secretary. They already ran on the campaign of the Texas Miracle. And then we discovered that he just displaced 15,000 Houston high school dropouts. And wow. The only reason we know about it is that parents started calling up when they saw the story in the paper about the Texas Miracle, saying, what do you mean no dropouts? My son's right here, sitting right here. My daughter's right here. Come get him. I want him back in school. That kind of concept. So when we think about the data, because we're asked to, because we've got to be careful. I don't think poor kids have a different style of learning. What I think is whatever Obama's children get, whatever Secretary Duncan's children get, whatever the wealthy and the powerful children get, guess what? I think if we do the small class size, I think if we give them the help they need, we give them creativity, innovation, inquiry, we give them, and Finland doesn't even test the kids. So if we give people the supports and we let them learn the way the wealthy learn, guess what? A lot of that stuff will fade away. It's right. Not all of it, but it certainly counts.
Well, that's it for tonight. The BAT conference was energizing, educational, and electric. BATs are all over the country, so go to their web page, badassteacher.org.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, in light of all the hubbub out of Jeff City regarding intern dress codes, I thought I would give everybody a little refresher on Missouri sexual harassment law. The Missouri Human Rights Act protects individuals against sexual discrimination and sexual harassment and discrimination based on their sex. This act applies to employers with six or more employees, and it also includes employers in state and local government. So that would include, in fact, the legislature, and it would also include insurance. It also includes other places like landlords and housings and property management and realtors, and it includes discrimination based on sex when it relates to accommodations as well. It is unlawful to discriminate against any employee or applicant for employment because of his or her sex regarding hiring, termination, promotion, compensation, job training, or any other term, condition, or privilege of employment. It's also unlawful to discriminate regarding housing providers, property management lenders, or any kind of tenancy. The Act also covers sex-based discrimination related to pregnancy, compensation, sexual harassment, and gender-based discrimination claims. Because of the news lately regarding intern dress codes, I thought specifically I'd talk a little bit about sexual harassment. Sexual harassment is a form of sex discrimination based on sexually explicit behavior. Unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature will constitute sexual harassment in three particular situations generally. Submission, one of them is, for example, if submission to such conduct is made a term of or condition of the individual's employment, like if you want to continue working here, then you will do blank. Submission or rejection of such conduct by individuals is used as the basis of employment decision, like if you want a promotion, you will do blank. And the third one, and this is where a lot of people get in trouble, and this is where I think people in the legislature have gotten in trouble, were conduct that creates an intimidating or hostile or offensive working environment. This is where the sexual conduct is so pervasive or severe that it creates an abusive working environment. This is called a hostile working environment. What you need to remember is that when something like this happens, there are things that you can do. You can report it to superiors, the one obviously that's not sexually harassing you, to human rights, to the Human Rights Commission. You can make a complaint related to the discrimination or to the sexual harassment. You can report it internally within your own human rights department to the superior of the person who is doing the sexual harassing. And one last thing, it is not the person that is being sexually harassed's fault. That is victim blaming. And I think that, and this is, again, this is my opinion, but I think the idea that changing a dress code will prevent sexual harassment is blaming the victim rather than putting the responsibility on the person that's actually doing harassing. That is all the time that we have today. Thank you very much for listening. You can find me at www.williamslawkc.com. Thank you for listening tonight, Kansas City. Be safe.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for August 20th, 2015. Women's Equality Week, August 23rd to 30th. Many events. For a flyer, go to Women's Equality GKC on Facebook. Jessica Newworth, Equal Means Equal. Why Do We Need ERA? Wednesday, August 26th. Reception 6 p.m., program 6:30 p.m. That's at the Central Library, 14 West 10th. Union Maids, the film about heroic women organizers from the 30s. Then special guest speaker Mary B. McMillan, Secretary-Treasurer of North Carolina AFL-CIO, and Women's Leaders for Fight for 15, Fannie Lou Hamer Women's Committee. That's Saturday, August 29th, 11:30 a.m. at the Tivoli Theater, 4050 Pennsylvania Avenue. And for anything you have a question about, go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org.
And we have a job announcement. The Retail Workers Union is looking to train and work with internal workplace organizers who are interested in working on an organizing drive at a Kansas City area location of a national retail chain. Once the inside organizer is hired by the target retailer, we will provide a comprehensive organizer training program and conduct weekly check-ins to guide the individual through the organizing process. Inside organizers will learn how to make a workplace map, how to keep workplace journal, how to conduct research and gather information, how to identify worker leaders, how to navigate organizing conversations with coworkers, and how to build an organizing committee in the shop where they work. For more information, contact Stephanie Basil, that's S. Basil, at rwdsu.org. And this will be posted at heartlandlaborforum.org if you want to read that again. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called Women's Equality Week. Two pioneer working women tell their stories. Janet Smith, union president, and Jackie Chadwick, cement truck driver. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.